Okay, well, anyways. So, the next topic is Shmoneh Esrei. So I'm going to go through different practices in Hagam Shmoneh Esrei. So we've seen Brichos Kriyat Shema, Kriyat Shema, and Shmoneh Esrei. The essence of tefillah in general is Shmoneh Esrei. That's when we say the word tefillah in terms of halacha in the Gemara, it means Shmoneh Esrei. That's the essence. That's the core. That is the paradigm of tefillah. That's the actual tefillah. The buildup of davening is leading towards that point. You have brachos, pesukei zimra, you have brachos kriyat shema, you have kriyat shema, and everything is heading towards Shmoneh Esrei. That is the moments where we stand there speaking to Hashem, privately as it were, private conversation. There's a famous idea from Rav Chaim Brisker, and just to say it in short, he says there's two types of kavana you can have in davening. One kavana is the kavana and understanding what you're saying. Knowing what the words are, being attached to the words, knowing what you're saying, understanding it. But he says the more important kavana is just the awareness you're standing before Hashem. He says that is the essence of what it means to daven. The words are secondary. Davening means I'm stepping before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Once I'm there, so then I'll make some requests, I'll give some praise, I have things to do once I'm there. Once I'm in the room with Hashem, then I have things I have to do. But the essence of tefillah is the fact that you're standing there before Hashem. That's what tefillah is all about. So the whole buildup that we are doing in davening is the preparation for those moments. I'm prepping myself that I'm going to be able to stand before Hashem, and I want to be focused, I want to have the right mindset, I want to know what to talk about, and that's the buildup. But the hallmark of the human being is the ability to daven. One of the terms used in the Mishnah for a person is maveh. The word maveh means, in a certain sense, a davener, someone who prays. And that's considered like a title. A human being is a maveh, is a seeker, is a davener, is someone who knows how to pray and approach HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's our essence, that's who we are. When you're standing before God in tefillah, you are doing something which an animal can't do. You're doing something which is the one of the primary abilities a human being has over other creations. We can stand before Hashem. Often the issue that we have is that we have difficulty having kavana, and I think one of the problems is because we don't see davening as a goal. We see it as a duty, something we have to take care of, to finish up. So we're not present. We're elsewhere. I'm thinking about what I have to do afterwards. I'm thinking about what I did before. I'm thinking about my menu for Shabbos and a grocery list and where I'm going next week and what I have to do next Tuesday. And we're not here though. We're not there at the moment. The way to really focus on davening. So having kavana is a goal, but really kavana comes when you're in the moment. If you're in the moment, then you have kavana. That's automatic. We shouldn't have to struggle with kavana because if we're there, we have kavana. The problem is we're not there. That's really the problem. Once you know that davening is not something to get through, something to finish off, but it's my goal. This to me is a primary point of my day. This is something I'm looking forward to. This is a moment that I want to be in. Then kavana comes much easier. It's not my duty. It's my goal. So you have nowhere else to go. You have nothing to do. What you have to do now is daven. You're here. You're focused, and then kavana comes pretty easy at that point. I think that's really one of the big keys to kavana. So that brings me really to the next point. I guess the first minhag of davening to discuss, which is when you begin Shmoneh Esrei, we have this minhag of taking three steps back and three steps forward. That's how we begin davening. The truth is, halachically, the important part is the three steps forward. Three steps back is not really a requirement. The minhag is to do it, I guess, just because it allows you to take three forward. Meaning that if you're standing there, you don't go three back. You've no room to go three forward, usually. But the halacha is to have three steps forward, and the minhag is to also do three steps back. And what's the reason for this? Where does it come from? So the Ramah says that three steps forward, I'll read you his quote, is derech kiru v'hagasha ledavar shetzarech lasos. It's you're approaching something that needs to be done. So it's like now I'm stepping up to task. I'm going to do what has to be done. I'm stepping into my role as the one davening to Hashem. So often we gain a lot from actions. We gain a lot from putting ourselves into the right mindset and the right environment through action. So if we just stood there and started davening, we wouldn't kind of change our mood. If you take three steps back, this is forward, so now I'm walking away from what I'm doing, and now I'm stepping into tefillah. And that's how we understand the three steps. I think it's symbolic of kind of leaving our world, our mundane lives, and then stepping into a spiritual realm. Now, three steps back, I'm leaving my daily routines, and then three steps forward, I'm stepping into the spiritual realm. I'm stepping into the room with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's how we should view it. And then that kind of gets us in the moment. It kind of allows us to be present because I've stepped into a new environment. I've left my environment and gone to a new environment. There are other symbolisms given to the three steps. The Kaf HaChaim, he says that the three steps back and forward, he says three steps back are a zecher, it's a remembrance of the three milin. A mil is a measurement, it's like we call it a mile, you know. So it's a measurement of the Jews at Har Sinai. When they heard Hashem speak, Chazal tell us, they jumped back three mil. They got so scared that they were startled and they jumped back. They fell backwards. So when we approach davening, we take three steps back to show that we're nervous. We're scared of Hashem. There should be a sense of reverence, trepidation. I'm about to approach the Borei Olam. And I jump back. And then I move forward. I say, no, I have a job to do. Hashem wants me to daven. I approach with humility. I approach with love. And then I come forward to Hashem. But there's this process in your own emotions of feeling a little bit, you know, nervous about it. And I jump backwards out of reverence. And then I come forward. He makes the connection. There's a pasuk about malachim. It says a malachim ratzo vashov. The malachim would run forward and come back. Run forward and come back. Now Rashi describes it that imagine somebody, you know, you peek your head out, you get scared, you go back in. They say, wait a minute. You peek your head out, you get scared, you go back in, and then that's like the emotion of the malachim. And many sfarim discuss like what is that like? You know, what's that pendulum? You're swinging back and forth the whole time. What's going on over here? And that, because that is the emotion we have with Hashem. With Hashem, we have the emotion that we want to come close and connect. We also have the emotion of fear and reverence, and who am I to talk to Kadosh Baruch Hu when we fall backwards? And that's a constant struggle within every single Jew, is that, you know, how much do I pull close, and how much do I fall back? And that's a constant, I don't know what you call it, a pendulum or a seesaw, whatever it is, but you're always going back and forth. That's Malachim Ratzov Hashov. So the Kaf HaChaim says that's davening. You go back, you go forward. Go back, going back says I'm scared. I'm about to approach the Borei Olam. It's a very scary moment. I move forward because I'm saying, Hashem, this is what I need to do. I'm approaching you with love and respect and humility. And then I move forward. But we have that constantly as Jews. The Rambam, just as an example of this, the Rambam says that how does one reach the love and fear of Hashem? So the Rambam says, you look at Hashem's beautiful world. I may mention this recently, I'm not sure. You look at Hashem's beautiful world, you look at the mountains, you look at the stars, you look at the beauty of the Bria. And you want to come close. You say, wow, Hashem is so wise, the world is so beautiful, so complex. I want to know the one who made this world. And then he says that you stop yourself in your tracks, and you fall back, and you say, well, who am I to stand before myself with my you know, small mind, you know, my little old me standing before the Borei Olam, who am I? And you fall backwards. And that's Ava Yira. Ava is that you want to come close to Hashem. The Yira is you say, wait a minute, who am I to stand before the perfect one? You know, myself with my shortcomings and my flaws, you know, little old meager me standing before the Borei Olam. But it's that same emotion of you come close, you fall back, you come close, you fall back. That's Malachim Ratzov Vashov. So Kaf HaChaim says that's davening. Davening is three steps back and three steps forward. The minhag is to use the right foot first when you start Shemoneh Esrei. And the minhag is at the end of Shemoneh Esrei, do the left foot first. So when you're finishing Shemoneh Esrei, you take the left foot to go back. When you begin, you want to use the right foot. The reason for that is the right foot, you know, most people are righty, and the right foot, being our stronger foot, shows that I'm eager to daven. So I go forth with my right foot. When I finish davening, I use my left foot to show that I'd rather stay davening. This is where I want to be. It's not a burden upon me, chas v'shalom, but I have to leave. So use your left foot to show you're a little hesitant of leaving Hashem. Now you're taking leave, but you know with reservations. So you use your left foot first. But you should use your right foot first to start Shemoneh Esrei, because that's showing that you're eager to approach Hashem. There's a kavod hashchina which is there, but you want to use your stronger foot, and you want to show that I'm excited about it. We know that the posture during davening is to stand with our feet together. Why is this? So the main reason given is because you're standing there like a malach. It says about malachim, it says, I think it says in Yeshaya, It says Ragliyam Regal Yashara. Malachim have, you know, one straight foot, it says. One straight foot, whatever that means. So we stand there with our feet together to demonstrate what Malachim do with one straight foot. It happens to be, even if you're sitting down to daven, let's say somebody is on a plane and can't stand up, or somebody is not feeling well and can't stand up. So you would still put your feet together even sitting down to daven. You want to keep your feet together at all times for davening. But the feet together, so one reason is because you want to act like a malach who have this one straight leg, whatever that means. The Mishnah Berurah says that when you're speaking to Hashem, you want to remove all material thoughts from your mind. You want to focus on what you're doing. You're connecting to Kosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, if you're ascending beyond your own world, you're ascending beyond, you know, the routine of every single day and acting like a malach. So you want to show you're like a malach. Malachim are above our world. Malachim are spiritual beings. So for those moments of davening, we try to act like a malach, be spiritual beings, try to transcend the moment, and like we said, be present with Hashem, not be elsewhere in our own physical mundane lives. So that's one reason given for having your feet together. The Torah quotes, in the Beis HaMikdash, the Kohanim, in a special way they walked. When they're walking around the Beis HaMikdash, it says they were supposed to put Ekev Besad Agudal, which means they would take very small steps where their heel would only go next to their big toe. I mean, they wouldn't go like this, so, you know, they would be like very small steps, so they're always touching the feet. That was also, sort of, I guess, an act of kavod, an act of being focused, and therefore when we're standing there serving Hashem, we keep the feet together, similar to Kohanim. One more interpretation given is brought from the Ma'ari Abuhab. Bais Yosef quotes it. And he says that keeping your feet together is a remnant of the fact that you don't want to run away. You have nowhere to go. Nothing else is going to distract you besides what you're doing. Now, if your feet are separate, it means, okay, I'm ready to run. When your feet are together, you're showing that I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying put. And like we said before, davening is about being in the moment, being there, staying put. I have nowhere else to go, nothing else to do. I am davening. And therefore, you keep your feet together. I think it's a similar idea. You find a few places throughout Tanakh and Halacha, it says by Moshe Rabbeinu, when he's at the Sneis, to remove his shoes. Right? It says, Shal Nalechem Yal Raglecha, take your shoes off your feet, because you're standing on holy land. The Kohanim Beis HaMikdash would always do a vote without any shoes on. They had to have their feet right on the ground. Yeshua, when he also greets a malach, and he's told to take off his shoes. You find places where shoes are taken off. So one of the meanings given to that is because shoes represent you have somewhere to go. You put your shoes on when you're leaving the house. If you're in a place where you have nowhere else to go, you're where you're supposed to be, you can take your shoes off. So Moshe Rabbeinu is standing on holy soil, Kiadmas Kodesh. He says, take off your shoes because where are you going? You're here with Hashem. Where else do you have to go? When the Kohanim are in the Beis HaMikdash, they take off their shoes. One symbolism of that is that you're where you're supposed to be. You're in the Beis HaMikdash. There's nowhere else in the world to go right now. So why are you wearing shoes? And it's a simple, so you should wear shoes during davening. I'm not saying not to wear your shoes during davening, but putting your feet together, showing that I have nowhere to run off to, it's the same idea, that I am where I'm supposed to be right now. I'm present in the moment. This is my goal. This is where I should be. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and I'm staying put. And you put your feet together to make that that gesture, that expression. It's like you're a captive audience over here. You're standing there with Hashem, going nowhere, and connecting. I have no other goals right now besides the goal of serving Kosh Baruch Hu. So that's another symbolism, having your feet together. I want to start at a different point. I think it's a Ma'aral, I'm 100% sure. I think it's the Ma'aral, but either way, the point's a good point. When you have your feet spread, so you're much more stable. If you spread your feet apart and you get pushed, usually you can stay standing. When your feet are together and someone pushes you, you topple over. You're much less stable. When you're more vulnerable in that sense. And it's said that when you're davening, you're trying to show that you are totally dependent upon Hashem. You are not stable without Hashem, you're vulnerable. So when you're talking to others, when you're in life, you keep your feet apart, you feel stable, you feel grounded, you're confident, and that's how you should be. And you know, and you're a strong person, and you don't topple over. When you're standing there before Kodesh Baruch Hu, you're showing your own personal weakness, a vulnerability, that you are not stable without Hashem, you need Hashem's help, there's necessity to depend upon Hashem. So you stand there in a way which is sort of unstable, that if you get knocked, you can get knocked over that way, because that shows that you're there you know, they're showing the weakness of the human being and the strength of the dependency we have upon Hashem. So that is that's the idea of having our feet together. We'll talk about Mirtz Hashem. We find time. The idea of Kedusha, also we put our feet together. That's the other place we do it. So we'll talk about the idea of that, I guess, at a different point. When you're davening, so the Shulchan Aruch says, I'll read to you what he says. What's interesting is that the Shulchan Aruch discusses, I brought the wrong one. It's the wrong one. Do you have the Mishnah Berurah here? I don't know if you have one. Oh, you do? Okay. I brought the wrong volume. If I can... So the Shulchan Aruch describes, I guess, the posture, besides the feet together, describes other ways to posture ourselves during Shemoneh Esrei. What I'll tell you is that most modern-day Svarim say that do whatever you do best for Kavanah. Even though we might say, put your hands this way, that way, stand this way, stand that way, you know, whatever, do the kabuki, turn yourself around, whatever it's going to be, but you should do the way which is has the most Kavanah. So, whatever I'm telling you now is what's brought down as minhagim, which some people do, and you see it sometimes. But ultimately, for ourselves, we should do whatever helps us to focus. So, for instance, the Shulchan Aruch says, Tzarech Sheyakuf Rosh Omat, when you're davening Shema Esrei, you should bow your head a little bit the entire time. So not looking straight, but have your head bowed over. Your eyes should be cast downwards. So again, for us, that may not be comfortable. They hurt our necks, you know, stretch our muscles. But your eyes should be cast downwards. And you should be thinking like you're standing in the Beis HaMikdash. And your heart should have kavana towards Shemayim. So the idea of having your head, you know, bowed over, looking downwards, it's an act of humility. It's showing that, you know, who am I before Hashem? I'm a humble person. So that's an important gesture due to create humility in a person. But you should be thinking in your heart towards Shemayim, meaning your heart is lifting up towards the Kodesh Baruch Hu. So that's one idea in the Shulchan Aruch. The Mishnah Berurah says that before you start davening, even though during davening it says have your eyes cast downwards, it says before you daven you should look out the window, because also looking out the window towards Shemayim, that also creates humility in a person. So there is an idea of shuls having windows. It's actually a minhag brought down. Actually 12 windows is the minhag brought down. I don't know how many shuls actually do that anymore. I haven't seen that so often. Each one's kind of going to shave it. But at least you can look out the window, you look at Shemayim, that creates humility, and then you daven with your eyes cast downwards, you know, in a posture of humility. The Mishnah Berurah then says, those people who during davening, Shemoneh Esrei, they look upwards with their eyes, like they're looking towards the roof. He says the Malachim laugh at them. So, I don't know exactly what that terminology would describe, but obviously it's not a good thing to do. So when you're davening, you should be definitely, even if you're not looking down, don't look upwards. Don't look like towards the Shemayim when you're davening. Then the Mishnah Berurah says, a person shouldn't do any wild motions during davening publicly. If you're privately and it helps you with kavana, then go right ahead. But publicly, you shouldn't be doing any wild motions. It sounds funny, but this was one of the big debates from the early Hasidim and Misnagdim. Because the Hasidim, even now you see it in some shuls, but certainly in the earlier days of Hasidus, part of their thing was during davening they'd be like all over the place, like screaming and jumping on tables and the floor, and like it was a whole thing. And they said this helps us have kavana, helps us have hislavus, we should be excited and exuberant about davening. And the Misnagdim were like, it's crazy, you know, it's not normal. And that was part of the dispute. So nowadays you do find it here and there. There are certain Hasidic places where you do find them still, like, you know, davening like that, which has its milas. There's definitely something to be said if it gets them into it more. But the Mishnah Berurah says, and this is the typical thing, is certainly publicly you shouldn't be doing any wild motions. The Tenua Mashunah, he calls it a weird motion during davening. And if you're in private and it helps you, so then that's your business. Publicly you shouldn't be doing it. And then he says that if you don't close your eyes during Shemoneh Esrei, you're not zeche to see the Shechina when you die. So Mishnah Berurah is quoting here that you should have your eyes closed during Shema Esrei.
The whole time.
The whole time. But then he says, but if you're using a sitter, and you're looking at the sitter, that's fine. So basically what's advised would be either having your eyes closed or eyes at the, looking at the sitter. But looking around certainly is not a great idea. Looking upwards is the Melechim will laugh at you. So don't do that. Or the Shulchan Aruch said you can cast your eyes downwards in an act of humility. So, but there certainly is something to keeping control of where you're looking, because again, for kavanah purposes, looking around is very distracting. If you look, if your eyes are, even if you don't plan to like look at it, once your eyes are up, you're saying, oh, what's he doing, what's she doing, what's happening over there? So eyes closed during the sitter would be advisable. Eyes cast downwards in a humble action is fine. Looking upwards, Malachim laugh at you, and looking around is distracting. That's what we see. So that's the next point in terms of the position during Shemoneh Esrei. The Shulchan Aruch says next, this is something that I have seen in some places, some do this, but again, you should do whatever is best for your kavanah. He says that you should put your hands over your heart, your right hand on your left hand, like this, in this position over here, and stand there like an eved before a master. So if you're standing there like a servant, so I guess this is kind of a way the servant would stand there sort of like pleading for his life or something. So this is actually, I think, quoted from Gemara, that some would stand this way. But they would stand with their right hand over their left, against their chest, against their heart, standing like an eved before a master, with ema, yira, uba pachad, with fear, intrepidation. So that's one way to stand, and again, that's supposed to evoke in a person that sense of abdus. I'm a subject of Hashem. I'm humble before Hashem. You know, Hashem, please, over your heart, I guess, is also some sort of emotional plea. And we stand like that. They say the right hand goes over the left because right hand represents chesed, and left is din. So you want to always have one. You want the chesed to overpower the din at all times. So you have the right over the left. As an aside, the chassidim are makbid to make sure their shirts button that way as well. Typical men's shirts button with the left goes over the right. I think women's shirts often are the opposite. You can tell me if I'm right, but I think like a blouse often is buttons the opposite way. But Hasidim, they're actually makbid that their shirts should button the other direction, so right goes over left, because that represents chesed going over din. Interesting thing. So the Shulchan Aruch says,
where do they get those shirts?
They're their own manufacturers. Hasidim have a whole system set up. But the Shulchan Aruch does say that daven like this, and then he says, if you're in a place where people stand this way before kings, it's the right thing to do. It's all based on minhag makom. So you should stand in a respectful way, stand in a way which you might stand before a dignitary, but bottom line is that you should do what's best for your kavanah, and that's what we keep on saying. So that's the next point in Shulchan Aruch, and then he says, certainly don't go like this, your hands on your waist. That's considered like arrogant. Like, you know, you're standing there like this. Like how, that's like the same action we do nowadays. Have your dive, don't put your hands like this on your waist. And then he said, the Mishnah Berurah says on that, he quotes also this idea we spoke about, I guess, a few months back about shuckling. We already discussed shuckling a few months back. He says over here as well, when you stand in davening, there is an idea of movement, and that movement, as we said before, displays, you know, the idea of fear, of shaking, you know, intrepidation, and a lot of different ideas of movement or davening. There's, as we said, there's many sources to the concept of shuckling.
Can I just say it quickly?
Yeah.
I would say it out loud. I was told that it's good if you can, like, I guess if you're home by yourself, to say it out loud so you're pronouncing the words better, because a lot of times people just slur the words when you're saying it.
Yeah, so if you're on your own, you should do whatever is best for you to say the words clearly, have kavanah. In shul, you should say quietly. Because if others are around, that could disturb others.
You hear some people saying a little bit like a loud whisper, you know.
Right. So you want to say it always loud enough that you could hear yourself,
right,
but not louder than that. But if you're on your own and it helps you, you could say louder. That's fine. Whatever. If you're on your own, there's a lot more leeway in these things because you're not disturbing others. No one's looking at you. You're not going to look weird. You can do whatever it helps. Whatever gets you going, you can do. So that's the idea of how we stand, how we speak, how we look with our eyes. The concept, we know in Shemoneh Esrei, we have several places where we bow down. Right? So in the old days, they would really bow down like on the floor. That we don't do for a number of reasons. I'm not going to get into that right now, but we don't go on the floor anymore besides Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, which even that's only certain spots, not the entire time. you go back, I guess, a couple thousand years, bowing down really meant bowing down. So that much we don't do. But we do have this idea of bowing down partially, like we do during Shema Esrei. The two places that's done, as we know, is the first bracha, Avos, beginning and end, and then Modim, beginning and end. Those two places it's done. The idea of bowing in general is an expression of submission. When you're down on the floor flat, you're totally submitted to the one you're in front of. You know, you've put yourself, you know, basically at their mercy. They could do anything they want to you at that point. That was that symbolism. You go before a king and you grovel on the floor. That's because you're showing I'm not standing up in front of you. No, I'm at your mercy right now. So bowing down is always that expression. Even if we bow down partially, and what you're doing is you're negating yourself before the person that you're bowing down towards. So certainly in America we don't bow down to anything anymore besides in davening with Baruch Hashem. That's the way to do it. Is definitely davening. You know, throughout history, different land nowadays, different places, different customs. You bow down to how do you greet others? How do you greet a king? How do you greet a dignitary? But we have an idea of bowing down. If you want to bow down more than in those two brachos, let's say you feel it's so meaningful and you want to show your submission to Hashem even more than what's mandated by the halacha. So the halacha is that you are only allowed to in the middle of a bracha, meaning you can't at the beginning or at the end. When you say Baruch Atah Hashem at the end of a bracha, or when you begin a bracha, you're not allowed to bow down during those points, except for the two places you're supposed to. If you really like bowing down, which I haven't seen that problem happen too recently, but if you really like bowing down, then you could do it during the middle of a bracha. That's what you could do. The reason for that is because the Gemara says that regular people bow down only during Avos and Modim, the first bracha and the bracha of Modim. It says that the Kohen Gadol or the Melech, they would bow down more during Shema Esrei. I forget which is which. I think that the Melech would bow down beginning and end of each bracha, every single bracha, and the Kohen Gadol just at the end of each bracha. But Chazal required people of that stature to bow down more often, but the regular common folk of Klal Yisrael bow down just at Avos and Modim. So if you start bowing down at the places where the king or the Kohen Gadol is supposed to bow down, so that's considered an act of arrogance. You're going against the kind of Chazal. Chazal said only bow down these two brachos, and you're acting like you're the king or the Kohen Gadol. So that's considered gaiva. However, in the middle of the bracha, they didn't say anything about that. So if you want to bow down in the middle of the bracha, that's okay, but you should not do beginning or end. So that's just a halachic note, even though it's not so relevant, it's a halachic note. How do you do it? What's the proper way to bow down Shema Esrei? So the Gemara says that you should go down like a staff and go up like a snake. Down like a staff. So what does that mean? So Rashi explains, picture you take like a long like stick and you throw it. So basically it goes down quick and flat. You know, that's how the stick goes. It just falls down at once. If you picture like a snake coming up, like a snake charmer, you know, like it gradually sort of like rises up. It's gradual. So the halacha is when you go down, you should go down quickly. When you go up, you do it slowly and gradually. That's how you should do it. When we say quick, so really to me, I mean just, you know, it's like that. When we say gradually going up, so the what's brought down in halacha is you should lift up your head and then your body, slowly. This is a place where you find a dispute between the common practice and the Arizal. The Arizal actually says do your body, then your head, on your way up. You know, I can't wish with my hand, but you know, your body and then your head. But our practice, the typical practice amongst, you know, Ashkenazi Jews, is to do the head and then go up to the body and do it slowly. The idea of going slowly on the way up is to show that, again, I'm hesitant to leave this position. You know, I, as a Jew, I feel that being submitted to Hashem is my goal. That's my purpose. And being bowed down is my proper position. But I can't stay here my whole life, so I have to come up. I do it slowly, again, to show those reservations that I have. You find many places, you know, in Minhagim and in Halacha, where we try to display that even though we have to leave, but we don't want to leave so much. We'd rather stay. Like I said, like taking a step back with your left foot after Shema Esrei. Like coming up from the bow very, very slowly. You're not supposed to run out of shul. You're supposed to walk out of shul. You're not allowed to run out of shul. Men take their tefillin off with their left hand because they're showing that I don't want to take my tefillin off. I have to, so I'll do it with my left hand to show that I'm hesitant because I'm a righty. So that you have a lot of places like that, halachically, where you try to show that you're hesitant to leave the mitzvah, and you do it slowly. So when you're bowing down, You have to stay. You can't stay there the whole time, but you do slowly show, this is where I want to be. I can't be here the whole time. I'm hesitant to leave. It's not a burden upon me to bow down to Hashem. So I go up slowly. How far do you bow down? What are you supposed to do? So the halacha says that you should bow down to all the, what's it called? All the little, like bumps in your spine. What is it called? The vertebrae in your spine until they like, sort of jut out of your back. Like you should feel that they're all sort of like popping out. Not literally, but you feel them. It's like when you bend over, you can sort of feel them coming out in your back. You should bow down until they're all, come in that position. You shouldn't go down to the extent that your head is across from your waist. But that's considered too much. That's considered also an act of gaiva, of arrogance. But you should bow down till at least all of the... So just a little bit is not enough. It's significant to the point where you feel those vertebrae popping out in that sense. If somebody, it's hard for somebody, somebody has a backache, somebody is sick, somebody is weak, so then halacha says, do your best. You don't have, you can do a little, Hashem sees that you're in pain and you don't have to bow down all the way. So if you have this terrible backache, and bow down is going to be excruciating, you don't have to bow down like that. But if somebody is weaker and in doing that's very difficult, you can just bow down slightly. But somebody who, Baruch Hashem, is healthy and feels good should be bowed down until all those little vertebrae are popping out from the back of your spine. At what point do you bow? What's the procedure? So the procedure is when you say the word baruch is when you bend your knees. The word baruch and the word berech means knees in Hebrew, and baruch, they're associated words. And part of the idea is that our knees are really a place where we show submission. You take a knee. That's something which is sort of showing submission to somebody else. Not take a knee like that. Not the political take a knee, but Like somebody who's on his knees. That was the position of bowing. So those words have a different meaning nowadays. So I didn't mean that. But when it says, "Ki kol berach l'chasichra," all knees will bow down to you. Now that's the pasuk we say in Nishmas. So that's what I mean by taking a knee. All knees will bow down to Hashem. So you say the word baruch, you bend your knees. When you say ata is when you should actually bow. And then the halacha is that you should really be straight before you say Hashem's name. And the reason for that is the following. There's a pasuk where we say, Hashem zokev kefufim. Hashem lifts up those that are bent. So you're supposed to, when you say Hashem, Hashem lifts you up. So you should therefore be straight up before you say Hashem's name. It says in another pasuk in Malachi, it says, Mibnei shmi nichasu. And before my name, you are lowered. So the Chazal say, before my name, you're lowered. But once you say my name, you're straight. So the process would be, again, you bend your knees at Baruch. You bow down at Atta. And then when you get to before you say Hashem's name, you should already be upright. That's the process. So when you say Modim, there's no bending your knees, because there's nowhere Baruch there, so you just go straight down. And you get to Hashem's name, Modim, you would then go up. But the whole process of bowing, besides the fact that it's we're used to it, it's a habit, it's just part of what we do. It's really an act of submission to Hashem. It's a very meaningful act, and the fact that we straighten ourselves up before saying Hashem's name is also very meaningful, because we're saying that Hashem is there to lift us up. And that's also something to think about. We can think about going down, being submitted. You can think about being lifted up by Hashem. It goes both ways. So as you see, all these different practices in davening. They're all trying to. None of these are ma'akev. If you don't bow, even if you're not together, it's not ma'akev. If you daven with your feet apart, you're still yotzei davening. You've done your mitzvah. But all these things are there to help us sort of zone in on what we're doing, to be in the moment, to be focused. That's really the concept. So those are the points I wanted to get to today. If I may share one extra thought here about Lag BaOmer. I was thinking of doing Lag BaOmer this year. I decided not to, but just, I guess, for a minute or two. Lag BaOmer is a day on the calendar, which it's, on the one hand, it has, I guess, the sources for Lag BaOmer are older sources. The Simcha Lag BaOmer is not all that clear. Like, why is it so happy exactly? And the Minhagim Lag BaOmer are interesting Minhagim. For instance, so the typical explanation of Lag BaOmer is that Rabbi Akiva's students were dying. He lost 24,000 students, which was a terrible tragedy. And Lag BaOmer, the plague stopped. So some of the Mefarshim asked the question, well, why is that a reason for Simcha? there's no one left to die anymore. I mean, the plague, it killed everybody, and that's why it stopped. He lost all his students. So now we should have a celebration. I mean, had it been that, you know, it stopped and he still had 1,000 students left and it was a nation that got saved, okay, we could talk about it. But he lost everybody. 24,000 students, that was his entire yeshiva. So why is that cause for celebration? Where did that come from? So the many explanations given that maybe that's not the real cause for celebration. That's the cause for stopping the Avelus, because the plague ended. So people, at that point, you listen to music and shave and get married, etc. But it's not a reason to celebrate. The Simcha of Lag BaOmer, so there's different explanations given, but it's the main one given is that you're celebrating the Yortzeit of Rishim Bar Yochai. That's at least certain nowadays, that's become the famous idea, that if you go to Meron, you see the crazy celebrations happening by his kever. That's become the focus. Some say that the reason you celebrate is because Rabbi Kiva, the Lag BaOmer's day, Rabbi Kiva gave smicha to his 5 new students following the plague. He lost 24,000 students. He then found 5 more. It's a big difference. And that was the day he gave them smicha. So he was sort of carrying on his legacy despite the tragedy. Some say that's the celebration. Habits be also Lag BaOmer is the day that the man started falling. So that was also something happy in the Midbar that we got the man from Hashem. But the main explanation is that certainly in practice of Lag BaOmer seems to be centered around the Yortzeit of Rishim Bar Yochai. That's where it seems to be centered around. So the minhagim of Lag BaOmer, there aren't so many. The two main ones, I guess, are number one, the idea of bonfires. And I know in America, they're around, but they're not that common. You go to Eretz Yisrael, I mean, the whole place is on fire. It's amazing. You stand there on one mountain, you know, you're in Har Nof, and you look across, and you can see, like, fires everywhere. It's an amazing thing. So that's very popular. There's a concept, you know, often, you know, schools have, like, a field day. Which goes back to the concept of using a bow and arrow. There used to be a minhag of having a bow and arrow on Lag BaOmer. So I think those are the two main minhag of Lag BaOmer. Where do those come from? So the idea of the fire, it seems to be that fire is kind of like Rav Shim Bar Yochai is a Yortzeit candle, as it were. You're celebrating his Yortzeit, and the fire represents, you know, his Yortzeit. And why a fire? So Shim Bar Yochai, he's the one who composed the Zohar. He's sort of the father of Kabbalah. He's the one who passed on to us the traditions of Kabbalah. So the Torah of Kabbalah is compared with fire in terms of its spirituality. It's, you know, you can't really grab it. It's ascending to Shemayim. Fire is an amazing thing that's always reaching upwards. It's not very physical. I mean, it's physical, but you can't touch it. You can put your hand right through. It's definitely the most spiritual of physical items that we have. So it sort of presents what Rav Shimon's contribution was to the world, which was the Torah of Kabbalah. So that seems to be the main understanding of the fire in Lag BaOmer, is to represent Rav Shimon's Yortzeit and the Torah which he gave to us, which is the Torah of Kabbalah. In terms of the bow and arrow, so the Bnei Yisrael has an explanation. He says that in Hebrew, the word for a bow is a keshes. And a keshes is used to mean like a bow, like a bow and arrow, or also a rainbow is considered a keshes. So Gemara says that, you know, we know in general a rainbow is beautiful, but it is a bad sign. It says in Parashas Noach that, you know, I'm going to put my rainbow as my sign to the world, that I'll no longer destroy the world. And the rainbow is considered to be mutzi diba. It's like spreading lashon hara about people. When you say, you're not supposed to point out a rainbow to others. Because why? Because a rainbow means that Hashem, you know, is remembering his covenant not to destroy the world. That's not a good thing. That's a bad thing. So as beautiful as it is, we can talk about separately, why did Hashem choose a beautiful sign as a bad sign? It's interesting that a rainbow as beautiful as it is actually a bad simon. But a rainbow is considered a bad thing. The Gemara says in Rav Shim Bar Yochai's lifetime, there was never a rainbow. I mean, to his merit. Because he was so great, and his merit was so powerful, Hashem never had thoughts of punishing the world during his lifetime. So therefore, in his lifetime, there's never a rainbow appearing in the world. So you take out your bow and arrow and Lag BaOmer on his Yortzeit to show the greatness of Rabbi Shim Bar Yochai, that in his lifetime there was never a rainbow. That's what Bnei Yisrael says. That's said about a few others as well. There's a few, not so many, but a few people in the Gemara, it says about them, in their lifetime there was never a rainbow. And that's considered a very big merit to have. Because it means that your schus can protect the entire world. And when you're around, Hashem says, I can't touch this world because this person's here. This person is so great, I'm not even going to think about touching the world this time around. Once he died, the rainbows came back. But that's the one reason given. So it's interesting. It's the one day on the calendar that we have such a celebration about a person's yahrzeit, to the extent where it becomes like a holiday. It's like there's a simcha to it. Because there's a question in general, you know, what's the idea of celebrating a yahrzeit? Yahrzeit usually is a sad day. Why would you make a yomtif about yahrzeit? And the truth is, usually we don't celebrate yahrzeit as a happy day. We remember those who are departed, but it's not like a yomtif. Chassidim do this. Chassidim on the yahrzeit of Rebbes, they actually make a yomtif out of it. But the way it's explained is that there is the happy element of a yahrzeit is that you can look at the person's life and say, look how much they accomplished. When a person lives a full life and accomplishes tremendously, so the yahrzeit is a day of simcha because look at the person, look at the legacy they left, look at the way they influenced the world, look at how they used their lifetime to do tremendous things. And that's the element of simcha on yahrzeit. Rishim Bar Yochai, he used his lifetime in a way which impacted Klal Yisrael for all of history. So we celebrate it. Every individual that's departed, they leave behind a legacy, leave behind accomplishments, and if you focus on those on yahrzeit, that does bring an element of simcha. I miss the person, but yet I can celebrate everything they've accomplished. And that's part of this idea. Okay.